This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning and welcome to the programme. It is very good to be back with you indeed. And we start today's programme with a woman who is a perfect antidote to any sluggishness a Monday morning in October can induce. That's because my first guest is Donna Patterson, a woman who took on her former employer, Morrison's, the supermarket chain, for discriminating against her after maternity leave. I'll share more details of her tribunal case shortly. But she couldn't afford a lawyer, so she took the case herself, with no legal training, cross-examining no less than 8 witnesses, some of them former colleagues. And she won. This is to be her first broadcast interview today, here with you, on Woman's Hour. The point is, Donna felt she was being discriminated against, but it was very subtle at first, and as you'll hear, there was lots of praise too. Maternity discrimination of any kind, or any different kind of treatment of a woman because she's had a baby and returned to work only to find her role has changed, and the perception of her too, is meant to be illegal in this country. And yet, we might not hear about many of these cases. Many of them are never brought, for a variety of reasons. We also don't hear about them, as many women aren't quite sure what's happening and what to do about it too, and feel powerless, as they still have a job, so they're grateful, but it's somehow not the same situation they left before maternity leave, or even the same role. This morning, I wanted to give you the chance to air your stories of such discrimination or suspected discrimination and what, if anything, you did about it, perhaps Donna style. So you can text me here at Woman's Hour on 84844. Text will be charged your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or email me through our website, or send a WhatsApp message or voice note using the number 03700 100 444. Data charges may apply, so you may wish to use Wi-Fi if you can. But I'll be talking to Donna shortly as your stories, I hope, start to come in. Also on today's programme, Katie Braben will be here, the star of the new Elton John musical, Tammy Faye, which tells the tale of the rise and fall of the TV evangelists Tammy and her then-husband, Jim Baker. The Olympic champion, Chris Boardman, the cyclist, on why he's trying to help women exercise outside in the dark as the nights draw in by telling men to keep their distance. I'm sure you'll have some views on that. And a view of the imminent US midterms from a former Republican strategist who believes the real war on women is being waged by Democrats. All that to come. But first, over the weekend, and you may have been amongst them, 15,000 people, mainly women, but there were some men too, took to the streets as a part of a protest called the March of the Mummies, a nod to Halloween. There's some fantastic costumes as well, in 11 cities across the UK, demanding, and a serious point despite those costumes, that the new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, urgently address the high cost and availability of childcare. But it was also about changing the culture of working life in the UK and allowing women and men to be able to be both a decent parent and worker. Mr Sunak has come under some fire for only having 6 female full-time members of the Cabinet out of 22. And today, at the appointment of Maria Caulfield as Minister for Women has also raised some eyebrows in certain quarters due to her voting record on abortion rights, having voted against the legalisation of it in Northern Ireland and supporting the cutting of the abortion limit. The march at the weekend was organised by the campaign group Pregnant Then Screwed, which also supported my first guest today, Donna Patterson. Donna returned to work having had her second baby, and her employer Morrison's gave her a full-time role despite her only working and being paid for part-time hours. Donna decided to take legal action against her employer, but the legal cover, which came with her home insurance, refused to cover the claim on two occasions, as they believed it would not be successful. They were wrong. The only option Donna felt was to represent herself. She cross-examined 8 witnesses during a 5-day tribunal and won a £60,000 payout for unfair dismissal and discrimination. I'm very pleased to say Donna Patterson joins me now in her first broadcast interview in the Woman's Hour studio. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
It's quite a moment for you, I imagine, at this time.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a whirlwind since the hearing finished on Friday the 21st of October. The lead up to the hearing has been a lot to deal with, but yeah, certainly afterwards. The attention and the coverage has been really unexpected. I knew what happened was wrong.
And let's get to that if we can, because yes. I think for some listening, they have been unsure if something's happening to them. And you nodded very knowingly when I said that about how you can be thinking something's happening and not quite sure it's different. What was it like for you?
Yeah, so there was lots of different incidents that led up to me eventually raising a claim. And individually, they probably don't sound like a huge deal. And when you're in an environment where that kind of behaviour happens a lot, you end up questioning yourself if you're overreacting, making a big deal out of something. But then when you cumulatively look at them all together, you then start to think, this can't just be me. I can't be overreacting. So a couple of examples are just before I announced my pregnancy, I was asked to take on a new role that I was quite interested in. I said I was interested. And then just for full disclosure, I thought I'd better make them aware that I'm pregnant because, you know, I'll be going off soon after taking on the role. And all of a sudden the role disappeared. I didn't raise any complaints about it at the time. I didn't want to be known as one of those difficult women who cause a fuss. I knew I'd be returning from maternity leave, so I didn't want any awkwardness. Then fast forward to going on maternity leave, a restructure was done, but I was assured the whole time, do not worry, there will be a role for you in this business when you come back. And then during my maternity leave, I was ignored when I tried to communicate, to talk about returning to work. But again, I didn't want to be seen as one that was kicking up a fuss or making things difficult, especially knowing that I would be going back. And then things just really came to a head once I had returned. And the role that I had been placed in, with very, very little discussion about it, was a full-time role. Everybody had previously performed it in full-time hours. And when I raised that with my line manager...
Because you'd come back part-time.
Yeah, I'd had a part-time contract for 3 years at that point,
right,
to try to balance the whole work-life situation. So I had an established part-time contract. And when I made my manager aware of that, he explained he had no idea that I had a part-time contract and that hadn't been taken into consideration when placing me in that role.
And did you then try to fulfil the role within those hours?
I came up with some suggestions. I suggested, could we job share with somebody else? Could parts of the role be removed? Could I return to the team that I worked in previously, which 50% of the team work part-time, so it's a really... a role that accommodates part-time working. And initially they were minded to move me to a different role. They said they would find me an alternative suitable role, and that was communicated out within the business. And then a matter of weeks later, I was told, oh, actually, we've decided there's no need to move you to a different role because the role that you are in is more than suitable for you. You are really experienced. You're great at your job. We believe you can do it. You just need to prioritise things a bit better and get your head in the right place and get your mindset right. And you can definitely do this with your eyes closed. And I just felt like I was banging my head against a brick wall, that nobody was listening to me. At the same time, I was going to meetings and being called out for things not being finished on time. My line manager was having to pick up substantial pieces of work because they just weren't getting done. And yes, once they had said that that was it, they were leaving me in that role, it was clear to me that I had to do something. Pregnant and Screwed were amazing. I spoke to them a number of times and they gave me some really great advice. So I began the internal processes of a grievance and then an appeal. And then ultimately I had to raise an employment tribunal claim because the internal processes that are meant to be there to protect you as a person, as an employee, just totally failed me. Every investigation found that there was no issue. The role was suitable because my managers had said it was suitable, without any actual validation that the role had been adjusted for me.
And once you launched a grievance, had you left by that point?
No. So the grievance and the appeal were conducted while I was still an employee. With all of this going on, me still trying to do the job, my children getting chickenpox back to back, my youngest picking up every bug going because he was a COVID baby and had little to no immunity, and then juggling the job, I spoke to my GP, explained what was going on, and the GP explained it's clear, you know, you are struggling with work-related stress and it is not an environment you should be in. So I began a period of sick leave and I tried continually to resolve things with Morrisons and we just couldn't get things resolved. And it was at that point that I raised the employment tribunal claim and I handed my notice in.
And you didn't have any legal representation. As I mentioned, you tried to have cover for this through your home insurance.
Yes.
That was declined. And so you're now, having coming off the back of that, looking at this with only one option, which is for you to represent yourself.
Yeah, well, yes, because I did speak to solicitors and the rates were so expensive. So it was £300 per hour was the cheapest solicitor price I could get. And it was an unknown entity of how many hours would rack up in order to pursue the claim. I did also speak and explored the no win, no fee option solicitor, but they were just so insistent on getting to a settlement and avoiding a hearing. And the money was never the appeal. What I wanted was to demonstrate to Morrisons what had happened and what had gone wrong and how I had been failed. So you're right. I then realised I've got to take this on myself and pursue the claim.
And how did you feel at that moment, making that decision?
Really overwhelmed. And I was questioning myself and continued to question myself throughout the whole period of time leading up to the hearing. Some days I would think, yeah, I've got this. This makes sense. It's logical what I'm saying. There's lots of other cases that I can refer to that have similarities to mine. And then other days I would just think, what on earth have I taken on? How can I possibly see this through? I continued to question myself. But what massively helped me was the other cases that I had read about that were successful. So, for example, Helen Larkin, who took on Liz Earle, the beauty brand, Pregnant and Screwed shared her story and she self-represented herself. And luckily I reached out to Helen via Pregnant and Screwed and Helen was an immense support. She was able to explain to me step by step as a litigant in person, which is what you are classed as without a legal representation, what's expected of you, what tactics might be used by your employer's solicitors.
how even to refer to the judge, I imagine.
100%. Sort of that was something I had no idea.
The logistics do I call in the language of legal representation.
Correct. And then, you know, things happen and catch you off guard. So, for example, I thought I was up against a solicitor, but at the 11th hour, a barrister turned up and sent me an email and said, I have been appointed to represent. So all of a sudden, I found myself corresponding with a barrister, which whenever in your life do you do that?
And what was it like when it began? I mean, I mentioned cross-examining people. These were some of them, people you knew and you'd worked with.
Yeah, there was a couple that I felt really anxious about because these were people that I had known at the beginning of my career. They had supported me and taught me a lot about what I know about the industry and my job. And they felt, I was really worried about those because it's a big thing what I was taking on. Others, I wasn't as worried about because I fundamentally disagreed with how they had treated me and I felt like I had been failed. So I also seen it as an opportunity to ask questions that had just repeatedly been ignored. And I knew that in the hearing, they had sworn an oath, so they had to give me answers that they'd previously avoided giving me.
Did you enjoy those ones?
I think enjoy is, it's a double-edged sword. There was satisfaction.
Yes.
And the judge, at times, what seemed to be as outraged as I was, which was really reassuring because I thought, I haven't been making this up the whole time. Somebody else, independent, who is legally highly qualified, is as flabbergasted as I am.
Yes. I mean, it's something to think that it's happening, then know it's happening, then do something about it. I mean, you've been compared to British Erin Brockovich in the papers in the last few days. I don't know how you feel about that. The woman, of course, that we know from the film, played by Julia Roberts, who took on her own legal case and, you know, a class suit.
Yeah, I mean, I love the film. It's brilliant. And I don't know, it feels a little bit strange being compared to somebody like that who you would have looked up to, I looked up to, and really admired. But I guess what I hope is that, just like I did with the likes of Helen Larkin and others that I read about, that other people, women and men, will read about my case and what I did and think, yeah, I've got an opportunity here. If she can do it, I can do it, which is the mentality I had.
And I know you want to help others and you want to help specifically women who've been through this or think they may be going through it, but what toll do you think this took on you? Because that's also not spoken about, because women are very grateful a lot of the time to still have a job.
Yeah, it's huge. I will never, ever underplay how big it was. It was grueling. It was exhausting. I was up until very late at night preparing, going through documents. And even during the hearing, each day I would go home each evening and I would be drained. I had nothing left in me. But pretty much every night I would lie in bed thinking, I'm glad I've done this. Like weighing everything up. Even if this does not go the way that I want it to go, at least I know I tried. At least I know I gave it my bestest shot. And then whatever comes of it, I can at least console myself with, I tried to make a difference.
We approached Morrisons, but they weren't able to provide a statement. Speaking to the Daily Mail, the supermarket chain said the following: we don't accept we acted in an unfair way and we believe a number of the facts have been misrepresented. We are considering an appeal. We'll see what happens with that. Are you going to have a lawyer if that happens, or are you yourself again?
I think it could potentially end up being me again, just because of the unknown legal costs that are involved.
And you've got a track record, which is what the law is often based on. Stay with me for now, because I just want to bring in Lara Kennedy, a lawyer with the Solicitors Lead A. Lara, you've been listening to the details and the position Donna found herself in. Good morning.
Good morning.
How common are these situations when women return from maternity leave?
Well, unfortunately, discrimination on the grounds of pregnancy and maternity leave is actually very common. Donna isn't alone in her situation. that a survey which was done by the Equality and Human Rights Commission now back in 2017 actually found that a staggering 77% of mothers have suffered these negative discriminatory experiences. And 54,000 mothers every year are reporting feeling forced to leave their jobs. This is awful. I mean, one in five of them are suffering from harassment or negative comments. Yet, despite these statistics, only about 1% are actually going to an employment tribunal. So it really does highlight here the resilience which has just been shown by Donna, enabled to stand up for her rights by herself, and hopefully she will inspire many other women to do the same.
Yes, we're getting many messages to that effect. Some to others, if I can, I'll share in a moment. But the it doesn't necessarily reflect that well on your profession, does it? It's very expensive to get a lawyer.
Absolutely, it is. I mean, I can't say it's not otherwise, which is certainly what makes those organisations like Pregnant and Screwed, Maternity Action and the others out there so valuable to women in Donna's position.
Well, I won't hold you to account for how much lawyers cost. I'll use your skill to better use if I can, because what I didn't know, and hopefully you can help with, is that if you take over a certain amount of time away on maternity leave, away from your role can be changed. That's correct, isn't it?
That is correct to some extent. So quite often a question many women will ask is, am I entitled to return to the same job when you go off on maternity leave? And that does very much depend on how much time you take off. So maternity leave is divided into ordinary, which is your first 26 weeks. And during that period, you do have the right to return to the same job. And during your second 26 weeks, which will take a woman up to her full 52 weeks, whilst you are still entitled to return to the same job, an employer might be able to show that there is some reason other than the redundancy why it's not actually reasonably practical, they would say in law, for her to return to the same job.
So it's meant to be a similar level, but not necessarily the same job. Is that right?
Yes. It needs to be suitable and it needs to be appropriate for her in the circumstances. So all of your terms and conditions, such as your pay, location, let's say seniority, shouldn't be any less favourable than what they were before you went off.
Thank you for that. I mean, also, I know I'll get a couple of messages about this. Time off. Not quite time off, is it? But time away from the role. I wish it did sound a bit more like that in reality. Just, Laura, thank you very much for that and giving us the position and also how widespread this can be and has been. Laura Kennedy, a lawyer with the Solicitors Lead A. Going back to a sort of a lawyer in training here, Donna Patterson, I just want to read you this message. And believe me, we're getting a lot of messages supporting you, people being in awe of what you've been able to do. We're also getting messages from people about their own experiences and women talking specifically about maternity leave. We've got this one from Tristan who says, "This is such a ridiculous story. Women who come back from maternity leave have far too much power. No small business could survive in business if this is now the precedent. It's ludicrous. No wonder women of childbearing age have a bad employment reputation. So crazy. Women expect employers to bend over backwards. It is just not possible in business." Donna, what do you say to that?
I would say therein lies the problem. That is a lot of the time the attitudes that you are up against. You are no less capable just because you are pregnant or you have had a baby. In fact, there's lots of evidence to support you are the most efficient you have ever been in your life. And the idea that women after maternity leave have lots of power, I can wholeheartedly say that that isn't the case. I know that some smaller organisations are probably do have concerns, but Pregnant and Screwed circulate a lot of information about how employers have got lots of support out there if they need it to understand how maternity leave works and accommodating that. But in my personal situation, we're not talking about a small organisation. We're talking about a huge company that employs over 100,000 people and they have extensive HR and employee relations.
Want to be a lawyer after all of this?
I don't know if I've got the stamina for that, but I absolutely will happily help make the self-representation process a bit clearer, because I certainly found that it's disjointed and there's not a lot of clear and concise information out
there. And that's what I know you're focusing on at the moment. Donna Patterson, thank you very much for talking to us this morning, and all the best and good luck.
Thank you very much.
A message here from Katie says, "Well done, Donna. Your interviews literally stopped me in my tracks. I'm both fuming, but I'm also so proud of you." And another one here, anonymous, which says, I think it's an interesting one to hear after Tristan. We have lots of male listeners, I know, after Tristan's message just then. Hello, when I returned after 6 months of maternity leave, I was told I wasn't given the promotion to head of department as I'd be too busy with my baby. I didn't make a fuss as I felt vulnerable coming back into the organisation after some time out and hearing other horror stories from friends. The job went to an unexperienced, unqualified man, ironically with two young children, who was later demoted and moved to a different department, and I was left as the most senior person to pick up the pieces and handle the work as well as my own job. I loved the work and my colleagues, so we all pitched in to make it a success. But later I was so angry with the chief executive's decisions and comments. And there you go, an anonymous message about how vulnerable you feel. And for the record, the chief executive was a woman. Keep your messages coming in, please, on your experiences or how you perhaps relate to this story, or you know someone that is, or your views of this, maybe as a business owner. 84844 is the number you need. Now, as the clocks go back and the nights draw in, it can get harder to find the motivation to go outdoors and exercise as a sofa beckons. I relate. That's even more so for women, with many citing safety fears as to why they choose to stop exercising outdoors, if that's what they've been doing in the warmer months, during winter. At the weekend, the Olympic champion cyclist Chris Boardman wrote about this issue as he was aware his wife and daughters were affected by this. Rather than putting the onus on women to keep safe, he wrote that he wants men to take more responsibility. I spoke to him just before coming on air this morning.
I've worked with Sport England for over a year now, and one of the things that we've realised is the barriers aren't always obvious. And in terms of it, its perception is just as important as reality. If people don't feel safe, then they won't do something. If it's not easy, then they won't do it. If it's not convenient. And one of the issues for women as the nights draw in is it just doesn't feel safe on the street. So I'll just stop doing that thing I've been enjoying in the summer. And the barriers is me. It's people like me and a perception of danger. And in some case, you know, that's actually been found to be true. And we can do some really small things to just make the streets and parks a more welcoming place. And that's what the article was about, really. Just let's see if we can help the women that want to exercise in the winter evenings as the nights draw in. Let's just help them do that.
You only say people like me, you're talking about men, and there are some specific pieces of advice that you've issued around giving women space, not talking to women that they don't know, along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, I think if anybody just says hello as they're passing, that's absolutely fine. But any other comment, even if it's supposed to be complimentary, just don't do it. It's not welcome. It's intimidating. You're moving into somebody else's space. If you're walking or running behind a woman who's doing the same thing, well, just either pause for a bit and give them a bit of space, or maybe cross over. And it's real simple, small things like that. I think where it gets harder is when you really have to try and affect culture change. And that's if somebody you know, and we tend to all know somebody who would just make a small comment or say something, then you ask them not to. You know, you can try and do it.
Have you ever done that? Have you ever said to a guy you know who might be someone who would say something to a woman they didn't know in the street, something?
No, I haven't. Excuse me, I haven't. But I've certainly seen, witnessed on the street and think, I didn't say anything there. And it might just take a simple, come on, mate. You know, something small that just gives people pause. And it's, you know, it's not a lot to ask. It's uncomfortable, but it's not a lot to ask to do that. And all of those things add up to just moving our culture and our streets the way we want it to go. And I've got, obviously, got a wife, I've got two daughters. And that's what gave me pause, really. And I thought about what advice would you give them? And I can, you know, all our phones are linked and I can see where my daughter is. And I'll check when she's on her way home. But I won't do that for the boys. That's not right. Not where she wants to live, and it's not where I want her to live.
I mean, women have talked about this for a long time, saying there's a sort of unofficial, unspoken curfew in the winter when it comes to exercising around the clock, and when women can do it and when it's light and when it's not. I suppose the problem is, and it'd be interesting to hear what the response has been to your piece that you wrote in The Guardian, is that the people, the men that you are talking to, aren't probably going to read it.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the first thing we do is you put it out there, and then we have to disseminate it and draw attention to it. And that's where, I guess, another point where people can join in, just say, have a look at this. It's actually, I'd never really thought about that. So we can all do our bit in drawing attention to just the small changes that we can make. And I'm coming at this from a point of ignorance. You know, I've been in a privileged position that these haven't been concerns for me. So I'm learning a lot as I go as well.
And in terms of whether you think this, you know, the idea of saying to men to change their behaviour, whether that will then, because you talked about the perception, make women feel like it's safer, you know, that's it's about knowing what will actually make that change. And what do you think it would be, having looked at the research, having started to learn about this?
Well, I think it's just, first of all, it's awareness, and then it becomes okay to make a comment. It's small things that build up, and I think if there's more tangible things that I could do, then I'd be quite happy to get involved. But as I say, at this moment, I'm really coming at it from a point of ignorance. I'm learning, and the small things, because I don't see them, I don't feel them, and so I have to be instructed. And it takes a conversation with my wife, which is where this started for me, or with my daughters to actually see that there's things they don't mention because for them it's become normal, that it isn't within their gift to actually change the circumstances, but it is within mine.
And what response have you had to the piece?
It seems to have been very positive. I think there's been a couple of calls of being patronising, but 99% has been thanks. And even that feels uncomfortable, because it's not something we should have to do, but we do. We clearly do. The fact that there's a response to it at all, and I'm speaking to you, says, wow, this really shouldn't be a thing, but clearly it is. And that, I guess, coming back to your earlier point, that is the point. It's raising awareness in the first instance that there's some small things that we could do to make streets more welcoming.
It seems to be on trend as well with the Home Office's Enough campaign, which puts the onus on men to take responsibility for violence against women. The Scottish Police have a similar campaign. I suppose just going back to the point about the men that this will get through to and the men it needs to get through to, are you concerned that the right men will not listen?
I think you start somewhere and then it spreads out, and then it reaches further and further. So you're not going to do anything huge with a single article, but it's part of a process of actually generally waking and normalising the calling out of bad behaviour. So it's part of a much bigger picture.
There you go. Chris Pornman, I'm getting involved with this particular discussion. I'm joined now by Robin Vintner, the North of England correspondent of The Guardian, who's a runner and wrote about this issue very recently. Good morning.
Morning. I think it's a bit of a stretch to call me a runner. I'm a runner for fun. I'm definitely not competitive in any way.
Occasional runner after Chris, the Olympian. But Chris getting involved in this, he said some have, very few, but some have found it patronising. Others saying thank you. Where are you on that?
You know what? It would be great if we as women can just say, you know, this is an issue that's happening, and it'd be, you know, nice if people would just listen to us based on that. But, you know, this is the real world, and, you know, there are unfortunately some men that would only listen to Chris Boardman and wouldn't listen to us. And I think, you know, if, you know, with being able to get kind of high profile men to join in and to add their voices to this, I don't see it as a negative thing. I think it's a positive.
Have you had incidents while you've been out running occasionally?
Yeah, I mean, nothing kind of absolutely terrifying, and nothing, you know, nothing that I should have been afraid of, really. But, you know, often you know, I think a lot of women have had this experience where, you know, you hear footsteps behind you, and you can feel someone running up behind you, and it's just a man who's running slightly faster than you, and it's all fine. You know, he's out for a run, you're out for a run. And, you know, I actually had one the other day. It was about a week and a half ago. I was running in the woods, and it was during the day, but, you know, the woods is, you know, it's a bit dark. And a man just stepped out in front of me, from behind like a load of trees and a wall. And he, you know, he didn't have a dog with him, and he wasn't running. And I was spooked, like, it, you know, it shocked me. And I think all it was just he was I suspect he was out looking for magic mushrooms, actually, because it was a good magic mushroom spot. And he hadn't
That's a whole other discussion, which we can't do right now. But carry on.
Exactly. he hadn't meant anything by it. You know, he wasn't meaning to scare me. He certainly wasn't meaning to attack me or anything like that. But it was just the way he stepped out, you know, came out of nowhere, that is enough to, you know, I didn't scream, but I could have done, because that's how, you know, that's how much I was shocked by it. And there are kind of all sorts of experiences like that. They're very small things, you know, just again in the woods, a man gesturing for me to take my earphones out. And all he was doing was telling me to keep going. But it's just like, that's kind of stuff's really unhelpful. You know, we're in the woods, there's no one else here.
I think what you're describing is the perception as well, though, isn't it? You know, so it's what's very hard to deal with. One side is the men who do actively make it a more threatening experience.
Yeah.
But the other side is how you deal with getting over the fear of the unknown and some of those experiences you've had before, which may not happen at all. And may be something that are holding you back and shouldn't be. I mean, I'm just looking at a couple of messages. You know, Sue's just said, I'm 64, fit and healthy, but I didn't go for a walk last night as my partner didn't want to go and I would have felt unsafe. I live opposite a park. It was a shame. And there's this active curfew, which isn't really spoken about, on some women when it starts to the nights start to draw in earlier.
Yeah, that's it. And that's the problem, really. You know, when I go running, I'm going running because I want to be outdoors. I want to get some fresh air, you know, see some nice nature. And part of it is the exercise as well. But you know, it's about being able to unwind and have some time to myself. And it's not that you don't get really, I know, statistically, it's very, very unlikely that something would happen to me. But out running in the dark, I can't get the same kind of relaxation and enjoyment from it as I would, you know, if it was, you know, daylight and I could feel completely relaxed.
Yeah, well, I think that's also a message that's coming through from people on the messages. Nancy says, brilliant, men absolutely need to get actively involved in this culture shift. And another one here saying, I recently went to meet my partner in town early evening. I walked through our local park. I was approached by a man. I gave him the benefit of the doubt, thinking he may be asking for directions. Instead, he asked if I could perform a sex act on him. I said no very politely, but I felt like screaming. I'm 25 now and I've experienced sexual harassment and assault just going for a walk since the age of 11. It's disgusting, infuriating and exhausting. Because I can imagine that some listening may be thinking, well, just, you know, have a bit more faith in the majority around you, which is what you're saying. But then you have an example like that where you're going for a walk in early evening and that happens.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And that's it. It is the really annoying thing because, and that's, you know, with all of these discussions, the difficulty is we don't want to say, oh, you know, we're afraid of all men, you know, all men, we have reasons to be afraid of all men, but it's just a very, very, very small minority. And unfortunately you can't tell, you know, if you're in a park and a man comes up to you, you can't tell whether it's just a perfectly innocent, normal, nice man who's asking for directions or somebody who wants to assault you. And, you know, we do keep having to say this over and over again because that message does not seem to be getting through to some men, I think.
Just finally, are you going to go running then? When you do go running, are you going to go outside? What's the decision?
I go to the gym now in during the week in the evenings, and then on the weekend I treat myself to a nice long run during the day on a Saturday.
And try and not cross paths with those who are suddenly appearing when looking for perhaps magic mushrooms. Who knows? Robin, thank you for sharing. Robin Vintner there, how you're trying to deal with this at the moment. Tammy Faye, the TV Christian preacher, who claims in the end she was saved by the gay community. A new Elton John musical called Tammy Faye has just opened at the Almeida Theatre in London. It tells the story of the rise and fall of the American TV evangelist Tammy and her then husband Jim Baker. The couple created a multi-million dollar evangelical empire. It included their own ministry, the Christian Ministry, and a religious satellite TV network, PTL, which stands for Praise the Lord, and a theme park. Their shows were watched by millions in the 80s, but the empire collapsed amid a sex and financial scandal that later saw Jim imprisoned for fraud and conspiracy. The musical features original songs by Elton John and Jake Shears of the Scissor Sisters, and the Olivier Award-winning actor Katie Braben plays Tammy, and she's here with me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I feel like I need to go and let you lie down. I did go and watch this on Friday. It's a wonderful performance by you. It's hugely energetic, and the cast, you know, looks like a fantastic ensemble. Did you know anything about Tammy before you took the role?
No, actually, I didn't know much about televangelism at all. I didn't know about Tammy and Jim. But as soon as you get to deep dive on that stuff, it's kind of extraordinary. And their story is kind of wild.
They're incredibly popular at their height, aren't they?
Amazing. I mean, they're very powerful at their height. And they had this satellite, which meant they had this reach into people's homes. They just gained more and more followers. And it actually became very powerful, in fact.
People may have become more aware because of Jessica Chastain winning an Oscar for playing Tammy Faye in the film The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Now there's this musical. Is that just happened at the same time? Randomly, or has there been a long-term interest by Elton John in this?
Well, I mean, this has been 10 years in the making for Elton and Jake, certainly, and has sort of really gained speed in the last sort of 5 years. I think it's really interesting that both those things have come out now, and I wonder if it's to do with... It feels like we're really polarised at the moment in our views of things and with cancel culture and everything. And when you've got somebody who, like Tammy, who sort of was a pioneer in sort of bridging those gaps between people and giving people, a voice to people who perhaps, certainly in the Christian community, in the conservative Christian community, didn't have a voice. I think that's really perhaps why it speaks to people at the moment.
There's a particular scene in the play where Jimmy doesn't want to do the programme, and Tammy does it on her own. And I know everything's not entirely accurate. It's to paint the picture of the power dynamics that were going on. She's a huge hit. She connects with people, doesn't she?
Yeah, I think she really had this warmth, and I think it comes from her. She's a huge empath, really, and she has a great... had a great love for people and a connection with people, and she really fed off that, and they really warmed to her. I think that was her power, really. She was just incredibly herself.
Yes, and I mean, she was also the only woman in a sea of men.
Absolutely, and that's not to be underestimated. I mean, I can't imagine on a day-to-day basis how difficult that must have been at times for her, at the time, in the 70s and 80s, that she would have sort of been up against it, really.
Because they started with puppets, didn't they?
They started
just to help her cause. She should be taken seriously as a TV preacher.
Yeah, I mean, they did start out with puppets, and I think there was part of her that would have been really happy to sort of carry on doing that and
to spread the word via puppets.
Yeah, I think just any way of spreading the word of God. And they were, they really believed what they were selling, you can't deny that. And they just became sort of bigger and bigger. And I think through, their partnership, Jim and Tammy's partnership, they sort of, their ambitions sort of grew.
Well, they really did. Let me play something else here from 1985, because Tammy Faye interviewed Steve Peters, a gay pastor living with AIDS, on their programme. It proved to be a seminal TV moment. Let's hear a clip from the musical.
I know you must feel lonely sometimes with people being so frightened of it, Have you found people are afraid to come up to you?
Yes, I have.
I heard our friend Pat Robertson suggest that you can catch AIDS simply by sharing a towel with someone.
Thankfully, that is not at all true, but, I mean, it's a free country and I don't judge.
To think you may never again have a hug? How sad that we, as Christians, who are supposed to be able to love everyone, are afraid so badly of an AIDS patient that we won't go up and put our arms around them. But I want to tell you that there are a lot of Christians here today who would not be afraid to put their arms around you to show you that we love you and that we care.
Thank you. Oh, thank you so much, Tammy, for using your platform to speak about this. I know that, well, in this climate, it's not the easiest thing to do, so thank you.
God loves you, Steve. He really does.
That was a major moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was huge. And I think you can't underestimate that. And I think that so much of her legacy is about that moment, actually, of inclusivity and, as I say, sort of giving a voice to someone who, on a Christian channel, where, you know, people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and, you know, Marvin Gormer were sort of so against, you know, the gay community.
These are fellow TV preachers.
Yeah, sorry, they're preachers at the time, conservative Christian preachers. You know, for her to give the floor to someone like Steve, who, by the way, is still alive, and Ashley, amazing Ashley, who plays Steve, is in contact with him, and it seems like such an amazing man. And, you know, for that to be so much part of her legacy, I think is right. And I think that's probably where really the genesis for this whole thing comes from, you know.
Well, I mentioned, you know, as it would be probably unexpected if you're thinking of an evangelical Christian TV preacher, it in the end, she says she was saved by the gay community and their support for her, because it all goes wrong. It implodes as a financial and sex scandal. Jim ends up going to jail. I mean, without going into all the details of that, what does it mean when we talk about what the gay community meant to her?
Well, I think it's hard to describe what the gay community meant to her, because they saved her, I think. You know, she was so persecuted, and, you know, in the press, she was brought down so hard, you know, from being lifted so high, she was brought down so hard. And actually, I think even more so than Jim. And I think that is because she was a woman. And, you know, the gay community, because she had an arms open approach, you know, they had an arms open approach to her. And I think also, you know, she was someone who was persecuted, and that very much is understood by the gay community, and they took her in. And I think,
and that, I mean, there's a lot of joy in this music.
Oh,
as
yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
I mean, Elton John has obviously done this, and, you know, working together with, you know, with the team that he's put together on this, you know, there's a lot of joy to try and show that relationship, isn't there? There's lots of campness, there's lots of, you know, quite sexualized versions of biblical stories at times. I mean, you must be enjoying a great deal of this, although there's a lot of pain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so fun to do. And, you know, we were talking about James Graham earlier, weren't we? And he's so funny. He's so funny. And then you've got Jake Shears, whose lyrics are just, as you imagine, sort of very sort of witty and funny. And it really is a joy to do. And it does, you know, for me, it is, you know, for me to play, it is an emotional journey. But there's so much joy in it. So much joy.
How do you come down after performing that every night?
I don't know, really. It gets to the point sometimes when you do things like this, it becomes your life. So actually you just live your life through what you do on stage. So I'm very boring in my actual life. I don't really do much. I just sort of like...
Well, you haven't built a sort of TV empire or a theme park on the side.
Not yet.
Well, she says right at the beginning, well, the words are, if I hadn't lived it, I wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's true that, you know, she was absolutely a pioneer, but probably didn't set out to be, you know. And, you know, that's why she's so remarkable, really.
Thank you for coming to talk to us, using your voice in the rare break it has. Katie Braben there, who's playing Tammy Faye. The show is called Tammy Faye, the musical. It's on at the Almeida Theatre until the 3rd of December. All the best with it. Well, I suppose keeping with the US, but to the political side of things, one of the most powerful women in American politics, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, has said she is heartbroken and traumatised by a violent attack on her husband on Friday. Paul Pelosi was struck with a hammer in their home. The man suspected to be behind the attack is said to have demanded to see Nancy Pelosi, stoking fears about political violence in the run-up to next week's midterm elections. The midterms are widely regarded as a temperature check on how the current administration is doing. All the seats in the House of Representatives are up for election, and a third of the seats in the Senate. Well, joining me now, Jennifer Kearns, political commentator, former strategist for the Republican Party, and the author of a new book, The Real War on Women, Time's Up for Radical Feminism and the Democrats' Liberal, Progressive, Socialist Agenda. Jennifer, welcome to the programme. I should say later in the week I'll be speaking to a Democrat in the run-up to these midterms, but good to have you with us. I thought we could start, because a lot of our listeners will have been following what's happened with Nancy Pelosi, with the family, and what's been said. I'd start with that. What is your reaction to this and the reaction today in America?
Well, it certainly is a terrible tragedy. You know, there's such heated rhetoric, I think, on both sides I think it's no coincidence that this happened, given the temperature in the room, so to speak. You know, there was a report over the weekend that members of Congress on both sides actually were given $10,000 stipend over the summer to actually increase and improve the security systems at their own homes, at their offices in D.C., and even at their homes back in their home state. So certainly you can understand that the temperature is rising here ahead of the midterms, just 8 days away.
Do you think this will have changed that, though?
You know, I don't know. And, you know, you've probably seen, as I have, a ton of conspiracy theories. And, you know, I spoke with someone last night who's very close with a San Francisco Police Department detective. And they said, no, despite all of the vast conspiracy theories that are going on, this does look like a simple case of somebody showing up to the, you know, first female Speaker of the House and trying to wait it out for her. And this, I think, really speaks to, again, on both sides, just the heated rhetoric and the need really to turn the temperature down on this.
Yes, although there's been criticism that Donald Trump, who is said to want to run again, has been notably silent about the attack on Paul Pelosi. Many Republicans haven't, I should say, but do you want him to say something?
Well, look, I mean, it's difficult for Donald Trump, I think, to say something these days. He's, you know, he's still banned from Twitter despite Elon Musk taking over. Look, I think some of these leaders are waiting to see what the evidence brings in these cases. I think that's the responsible thing to do. And I think, you know, Donald Trump's focused on what he needs to be focused on, which is getting his endorsed candidates to win 8 days from now.
Well, it's not that difficult for Donald Trump to make his voice heard. He doesn't need Twitter, does he? He can say, he can express sorrow and concern, and we do seem to be able to hear him if he wants to make a statement. You've talked about, and you have a belief in the so-called red wave, a big swing towards the Republicans in the midterms. Do you think that's still likely?
I do. I think even more so now. And I'll tell you, when the news of the Dobbs case broke in the U.S. Supreme Court in June, I thought, here we go. Republicans won't stand a chance, right? Because the left will be so motivated to get out to have a solution to Roe versus Wade being overturned. But as we've gone through the months and weeks here to the midterm elections, what we've actually seen is women voters in America caring a great deal about a range of other issues and not just abortion. And it shows to me in looking through, you know, the history of women voters, including the huge turnout in 2018 during the Trump administration, that women are actually thinking quite differently this midterm season, and they're looking at a range of other issues. The reason I wrote the book, The Real War on Women, is I first heard the term the war on women back in 2013 when I was helping with a focus group in the battleground state of Colorado. And it was really the first time I had heard the phrase. And of course, it referred to this battle that was being waged on women, mostly by, you know, white male Republicans. And I thought, gosh, have I been an unwitting party to this? Is my party really the party that's been perpetrating this? And as I began to really dig in and research, and I had been a researcher and writer for the most watched presidential debate in America. I'd been a writer for Megyn Kelly. And we had asked a very tough question of Donald Trump, who you just mentioned, about his treatment on women. And so as I really began to dig into the research, I researched Democrats on 14 different policy points, everything from the government lockdowns to the defunding of police the last couple of years in America to foreign policy to the march to socialism. And what I found was that it was really the Democratic Party today that is waging this war on women. And I looked at the lockdowns first because that was just the most recent thing in my mind, and I really came to find that 2 million women left the workforce during the government lockdowns. Now, to be sure, some of that was due to COVID and the pandemic and the precautions that were set up in place in America. But by and large, these took place in very large blue Democrat-led cities, places like New York City and Los Angeles, and blue states like California, Michigan, and New York. And what I found was that women at two critical points during the pandemic left the workforce. So 1 million women left the workforce in September of 2020, and another million in America left the workforce in January 2021. Now, why did they do that? They did that because, at an even more granular level, Democrats who were running school boards and in charge of cities were keeping schools closed. And so women, you know, were kind of having this conversation, you know, who is going to stay home and take care of the kids? And so that happened to be, Emma, the largest exodus of women.
Isn't that a structural issue, though, with society? And we see that in our own country, rather than a political party waging war on women. And on your point about Roe v. Wade, if you look at the polling, I mean, there's polling by YouGov done, there's other polling done to show that more than half of all Americans disapprove of the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. So it's been attested that Republicans like yourself, those who've supported the Republicans as well, want to turn the attention away from that because it is something that matters greatly and more to women.
Well, to address the structural problem, you look at daycare centers, even in Los Angeles, were closed. So were the ones in New York City during this whole time period. And this really led to, and I was very surprised by this, feminists have always prided themselves on being a friend to the working woman, having equity in the workplace. You know, I heard your earlier segment with the sexual harassment case. But what I really found was that Democrat policies were quite unfriendly to women. And we had the largest exodus of women from the workforce since the feminist movement began.
You don't identify.
Under the Democrat lockdowns.
You don't identify, sorry to break in, as a feminist. Is that right?
You know, I do, actually.
Okay.
And I was taught at the university level that you could be a feminist, even if you were a conservative.
Yeah, yeah. It was just the way you said that. Feminists, like, they're over there and they're not with you. But I'm just talking about
the movement in general. And I thought that was quite stunning that was the largest exit of women from the workforce since the feminist movement began, and really in American history. And look, in terms of Roe versus Wade, I mean, this was really a point that I thought the Democrats would win the midterms on. As I said, when I heard the news come down in June, the first phrase out of my mouth was, uh-oh, you know, Republicans had better watch out here. This is a highly intensive issue at the ballot box. But what I have found, where there were two major polls last year, and these were no conservative outlets. This is the Gallup poll and Pew Research Center. They actually found some interesting views on abortion by Americans, and it's hard for the left to believe, but 65% of Americans no longer believe in this sort of on-demand, on every corner, in every doctor's office, unfettered access to abortion. And this is quite interesting. The religious right for years, and especially in the Bible Belt states, they've run these bills called the so-called heartbeat bills. And 5-10 years ago, these were considered very controversial, very conservative, very, you know, Bible-belting sort of laws. But can you believe 85% of Americans now believe in those so-called heartbeat bills? 85% of Americans now believe, according to those two polls, that if you can hear a baby's heartbeat, you should no longer be able to abort the baby. And so I think in the midterm elections, the far left, the Democrats, the Planned Parenthoods, they have vastly made a strategic error here. And I did campaigns for 15 plus years.
Yes.
I think they banked too much on this Dobbs decision, too much on this Roe versus Wade issue.
You're talking there, just in case people don't know, about Kansas having a referendum where they actually voted to keep abortion protections in the state constitution. Jennifer, that's all I've got time for, but thank you very much for joining us. Jennifer Kearns, author of this new book, The Real War on Women, former Republican strategist, and I'll be speaking to a Democrat later this week. Thank you very much for your company this morning. Back tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
From the makers of The Battersea Poltergeist and Uncanny, a new paranormal podcast series from BBC Radio 4, The Witch Farm.
People always say, oh, I'd love to live in a haunted house. They bloody well wouldn't.
The Witch Farm is the true story of an ordinary couple in an extraordinary, terrifying situation.
I don't think I've ever come across a case with this much phenomena.
I call her the Grey Lady, like a black and white image. There's no colour to her at all.
So you believe that the devil is real?
Definitely.
Leave us alone! Get out of our house!
The Witch Farm. Subscribe on BBC Sounds. Welcome. to Britain's most haunted house.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.